From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. Hello, Max. Hello, Aaron.
Always a joy to hang out 5 minutes a week introducing this podcast. Who is on the show this week?
You guys want to hang out more? We can hang out more. No, I'm down.
This is just right. This is just right.
That might be the quickest, Evan, that Aaron has put us down in an intro. That might be the record. Evan, who'd you talk to?
For this week's show, I talked to Kashmir Hill, who is a reporter at the New York Times currently. You're both no doubt very familiar with her work over the years, particularly back when she was at Gizmodo and even before that at Forbes. She did these amazing stories where she immersed herself in a kind of dystopian technology situation. She famously tried to live without any sort of major tech services for a period. She tried to live on Bitcoin back in like 2012, 2013, which was a tough thing to do at the time. But at the New York Times, in addition to those kinds of stories, she broke the story of this facial recognition company called Clearview AI. She's done a bunch of stories on it for the Times. She's now written a book on it called Your Face Belongs to Us, which dives into the incredible cast of characters behind this company. So I wanted to talk to her about all those old stories and also how she got this one. And we did it at the New York Times in a studio, which was quite a treat.
I have to say, there's a nostalgia to the Kashmir Hill byline for me. Because there was a period of my life, like when my brain would go into a holding pattern where I would just start typing Gizmodo kind of as like a self-comforting thing. It was probably my first autocomplete, I think, on the bar during like my most peak internet addiction. So it's possible I read like almost every Kashmir Hill article, including like the roundup-y, like these new earbuds are great kind of articles.
I still sometimes just reflexively, when I'm bored, start typing Deadspin into a URL bar. And then I'm like, I don't look at this new Deadspin. I want to look at I'm looking at that 2008 Deadspin.
I just want to say that it's sad. We've been doing this show for many, many, many years. One of my great enduring sadnesses is that like a lot of those websites from peak internet not only are not currently publishing, but do not like even have that those eras online. So I want to pour out a little internet wine for the dead websites out there.
While we're here, Aaron, are there any other of your enduring sadnesses that you want to tell us about?
I'll save my we could make this a weekly bit. Aaron's enduring sadness of the week. I definitely have some other ones to bring up, but I don't want to put off this interview for too long.
We are brought to you by a website that you can go to at vox.com. We make the show with them, and we thank them for their partnership.
Here is Evan with Cashmere Hill.
Cashmere, welcome to the Long Form Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like I've wanted to have you on the show for a really long time. I'm a huge fan of your reporting and your writing, and I have been for a really long time, which we'll talk about. We've covered some of the same things over the years.
Yes.
I think you've written the most stories that I'm jealous of any reporter that I know.
Oh, so thank you. Vanish. Well, your Vanish was one of the first pieces I kind of encountered in my early journalism career where I was like, ooh, this is an amazing first person story that I want to do something like this.
I love that. So that's nice to hear because I love that mode that you get in when you put yourself in the middle of the stories. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the book. I want to start with how the tip came to you and where you were and what the situation was when you found out first about this facial recognition company.
Yes. So I got this tip in the fall of 2019. I was in Switzerland on my fellowship program. I was in my hotel room. I was 7 months pregnant and it was around midnight. So everyone else I was with was out partying and I was going to bed. And I open up my email and I have a message from a guy named Freddie Martinez, who's a public records researcher. And he said that he had come across a company that he'd never heard of before called Clearview AI that claimed it had scraped billions of photos from social media sites and the public web to build a facial recognition app that worked incredibly well. And I just remember him saying in the message, you know, they've crossed the Rubicon on facial recognition technology, and I don't think anybody knows about it. And I called him right away, since it was a decent hour in the States. Uh-huh. And I said, I am very interested. I'm in Switzerland right now, but I really want to chase this down.
And what caused you to want to call him right away? Like, what was it about this that you knew, like, this is something I want to get on immediately?
Well, I'd been covering privacy and technology for a decade, and I immediately flashed to this conference I had gone to 10 years earlier at the Federal Trade Commission, where it was all the big tech companies like Google and Facebook and these little startups, one called SceneTap that was putting cameras in bars to allow you to look and find out what the ratio of men to women were and the age of the people at the bar, et cetera. But they had all been there to discuss what to do about facial recognition technology because it was just starting to get good enough to deploy in products. And, you know, there's a lot of debate between the tech companies about what they should be doing and the government, what they wanted the tech companies to be doing. But the one thing that everybody agreed on was that nobody should go and build an app that could identify anybody, that could identify a stranger. They said, okay, this is the one thing we shouldn't do with the technology. And now I'm looking at this email that's telling me that it happened and it's been done by a company I've never heard of before. And when I look them up online, there's very little about them. And I just knew in my bones this was a huge deal if it was true.
And did you know this guy that sent you the tip? Had you had any previous relationship with him and as a source or?
Yeah, Freddie Martinez was a person I had met before kind of in security and privacy circles. He had actually done some journalism work and I knew who he was and I knew that this was likely to be a promising tip. And he also included the documents that he had gotten from the Atlanta Police Department. And it included this legal memo that said privileged and confidential at the top of it. It was written by Paul Clement, whose name I immediately recognized. He's a former top attorney for the United States under George W. Bush. And just a big deal, expensive lawyer to hire now in private practice. And he was saying in the memo, they've built this tool, it works. And he was, it seemed to be that the audience was police departments, and he was explaining to them why this tool was not illegal, that it didn't break the law, and they were allowed to use it. And I just, it really was stunning.
When you're preemptively writing the memo that says, this does not break the law, I assure you, there's obviously a question has arisen already, even internally.
Yes.
About the nature of the technology. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the tip first and then go backwards because I feel like a lot of people might think, oh, you work at the New York Times, you get tips all the time, which I'm sure is true. People randomly send tips to people at the New York Times. But I feel like this kind of tip is actually the product of many years of work. So let's go all the way back before, you said 10 years before you'd been at a facial recognition conference, but go all the way back to what sort of prompted your initial interest to get into reporting about technology and privacy and kind of the intersection of those?
Yeah, I mean, part of it was that I became a journalist a little later in life. I wasn't interested in journalism as a young person beyond reading it. And I graduated from college, didn't know what I was going to do with my life, went to work for a law firm for a little while as a paralegal in D.C., a big corporate firm called Covington & Burling. And while I was there, started getting interested in journalism because I was assigned to work on this case involving Tyco, which was this, it was like a big white collar crime trial that was happening at the time. And I was sent to the trial to take notes to figure out what was coming out that was going to be damaging for shareholders who Covington was representing. And what I was doing was pretty granular and not as interesting to me as what the journalists were doing in the courtroom. I was writing about, like, you know, backdated stock options, and they were writing about the $6,000 shower curtain that the CEO
Wasn't
had
there
bought.
A party in this
Dennis Klosowski, the CEO, had thrown a shareholders meeting in Sardinia that happened to be at the same time as his wife's birthday, and I think her friends were invited. So there were just all these juicy details that were coming out, and the journalists were getting to write it up in a really fun way, where I was writing these legal memos that were not as fun to write. And I thought, oh, I want to be a journalist. And so had no experience. I ended up working at a nonprofit for a while and finally kind of got my big break because I was friends in DC with David Latt, who was kind of one of the famous early bloggers. Mm-hmm. And he started a website called Above the Law. And he was running it on his own. We were friends. One Friday, I think he had a doctor's appointment and needed someone to take over the blog, knew I was interested in journalism. So I started writing for Above the Law that day and kept going. And, you know, this was kind of like Gawker for lawyers. Mm-hmm. We were writing about law school students and lawyers and judges and just people that wouldn't usually be subject to coverage by a news organization. And so I found myself thinking a lot about how you invade people's privacy as a journalist, how much information I would find out about these people. I would go to Facebook and just, you know, if they're involved in some kind of criminal activity. I remember there was somebody who burned down a September 11th memorial. And when I went to his Facebook page, he'd kind of documented his whole night of drinking that led to that. And I was just struck by how much we were writing about ourselves online and how I could find it. And then I was a bit, there was kind of, it was during that time on the internet when bloggers were kind of people of interest. Yeah. And so the readers of Above the Law would find out things about me. They like found the old MySpace, you know, profile that I'd forgotten about. They discovered my OkCupid dating profile and had links to it in the blog. And so I just started really thinking about what does the internet mean for our privacy, and was writing initially about the intersection of the law and privacy and kind of backed into getting to know a lot about technology because it was dictating so much of how kind of notions of privacy were changing.
And did you come from a perspective of finding that creepy, finding it dangerous at the time, or was it more, because I remember that time, I mean, when it first started to feel like things were turning a little bit and people started to look at the dangers, it was very easy to dismiss it then. People were very dismissive of the idea that online privacy was important. I mean, Wired had been writing about it for years, but I feel like it wasn't taken as seriously. But did you latch onto it as like, I'm actually worried about this for myself, or more just like, this is an interesting area to explore that people aren't looking at?
I latched onto it as it was interesting to explore, and I was skeptical in a way of how much privacy mattered. I started a blog called The Not So Private Parts, and I would say my views have actually changed a lot since then. I've learned a lot over the last decade, but I just felt like a lot of people were talking about kind of data collection, you know, how there are all these apps on your phones that are collecting your location and gathering information about you for targeted ads, but I just wasn't seeing the harms. And so what I really wanted to focus on was, when is it harmful? When is somebody really hurt by this versus the benefits that we get from kind of being able to access all this information? I remember the famous example back then of how beneficial this could be was the Google flu report, where they could tell based on what people were searching, like how the flu is moving through society. Though I think that since there's been doubts raised about actually how scientific
I wrote
that was.
That at the time.
Yes. But yeah, that was my perspective. I was kind of, I was skeptical, and I was just trying to point to, well, here's where people are really actually getting hurt by the use of their information in these unexpected ways it's getting collected.
Mm-hmm. And then you kind of went on to do this series of stories over different publications. The first one I remember of yours was I lived on Bitcoin for a week, which was the first one I distinctly remember being like, that's a really good fucking idea right there. Like, I should have thought of that, you know? Like, it's always when you see something like that, you're like, why didn't I think of that? How did that start for you? Like, that idea that you would sort of put yourself in as the guinea pig or at least immersive reporter?
It actually came from journalism school. I ended up, after I started blogging for Above the Law, I went and did a magazine journalism program at NYU. And I studied with a professor named Ted Conover, who's kind of a master of the craft, and took this class where we were supposed to develop a beat, develop a niche. And that's where I chose privacy. And so I actually developed this not-so-private parts beat in journalism school and was studying with Ted Conover, Robert Boynton, and they had us really study first-person journalism and think about how to write that story, how to write it in a compelling way where it's not just your journal. You're just using yourself as a vehicle for digging deeper into a topic. So yeah, I'm one of the few people, I think, who can really solidly say I'm so glad I went to journalism school. It really paid off.
Well, I mean, if you're going to learn about immersion journalism, yeah, it's good to learn it from the guy who, I think he literally wrote a book called Immersion Journalism, Ted Conover. So,
yeah. So that's where it started. And yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the Bitcoin series, because I have heard from a few other journalists who said, I kind of was thinking about doing that and I bought Bitcoin, but then you did it. So then I kept the Bitcoin and I'm so glad because it was worth so much more later.
No way.
Yes.
I mean, it was like $100 or something.
It was worth
back then.
It was worth $90 when I was living on Bitcoin the first time. And during that week that I was living on it, I mean, it was hard. I like lost weight because it was hard to find food I could buy with Bitcoin. I had to move out of my apartment briefly because my landlord didn't want to accept Bitcoin as my rent. But I wound up taking a bunch of people out for a big sushi dinner at like this one restaurant that accepted it. And the sushi dinner was something like 10 Bitcoin, which it's fluctuated in price around the time. At that time, you know, it was like $900, $1,000. And since then, I think that dinner has been valued at something like $600,000. So sometimes my husband is like, why didn't you just keep all the Bitcoin?
Now, when you do these type of stories, you mentioned like having trouble paying your rent, and then a couple of other ones from that era or a little bit later that I remember are the really famous one where you stopped using the big technology companies' products or tried to stop using all flavors of their products. And then where you set up your apartment as an entire like surveillance, everything was online. So it was basically like a surveillance apartment. Are those stories, are they better if something goes wrong, you know, like not being able to pay your rent? Like, how do you sort of find the way to tell the story through that methodology?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you, when you're doing this, I like immersion journalism is the nice, you know, the nice term for it. It's also stunt journalism.
It always made me so mad when people said stunt journalism.
I don't mind. I mean, it is a stunt. It is something you have to really lean into. Like, I think you can't kind of have to it. You have to think about what's the most extreme version I can do of this because you want it to be really interesting. And so, you know, if you're going to live on Bitcoin but still, you know, pay your rent in dollars, it just isn't as challenging and you're not going to have those pain points that give the the narrative some texture and flavor. So I don't look for things to go wrong, but they often do because the future is so broken, you know? and I will definitely seize on those moments. But yeah, it's so often. I remember living when I turned my San Francisco apartment into a smart home and was working with a technologist, Surya Matu, to monitor all the data going in and out. And so he built this special VPN so we could see it. But I think the appeal of a smart home and smart devices is it's supposed to make your life so much more convenient. But I was just so frustrated all the time. So it wasn't just about the loss of privacy and all the data that was flowing out of this house, but it was just like so hard to turn on the lights. And I had this smart coffee machine that I thought I could just like tell Alexa in the morning, like make the coffee for me. But it was this complicated prompt I had to give it. And every morning when I woke up without caffeine, I forgot how to say it. And so I would be telling Alexa over and over, like tell the Bmore to set the brewing. I can't remember now. And my husband would be like, can I please just get up and walk to the kitchen and just press the button for us? And I'd be like, no, I have to do it the smart way. So I do fully immerse myself when I immerse myself to try to get the most out of the experience.
And do you sort of start with a thesis that you're trying to provide the reporting for? Like I'm thinking of the one where you gave up, you know, Google, Apple, and all these services, Microsoft, which was the easiest one, if I recall. And I wondered if, to what extent you said, I'm going to show how hard this is, as opposed to, maybe this won't be that hard. I'm like an open-ended question versus a kind of like directed question.
Yeah, with the getting away from the tech giants, part of it was a follow-up on the smart home story. And I was kind of wanting to get away from technology because it had been such a frustrating experience. But the genesis of that one is that writing about kind of the harms of technology and especially of free products that offer so many benefits like Facebook, like Google, I would often see people react to the story by saying, hey, if it's this harmful to your privacy, if it's this intrusive, just don't use the product. And so my real question there was just, is that really possible? And I knew from all my reporting how kind of deep the tendrils go, that it's not just deleting your Gmail account. It's that you're going to encounter Google all over the web in places that you don't expect. And so going into it, I knew it would be hard. And probably, you know, if I come up with a stunt and it's not hard or it's not interesting, then I don't tend to write that story. And I can't think of that happening off the top of my head, but I definitely know that it has happened where I did a stunt and I was like, well, I just don't think there's enough here to really write about this.
Mm. And as you mentioned, your husband, I mean, as time goes on, other people enter your life, like husband, children, and these immersive journalism experiences come to involve them. So what does that look like for you? You've done even one at the Times that really featured your husband, where you were tracking him everywhere. And so I'm interested in how you, is it sort of like a known thing in your family now? And you're like, actually, I got a new one. Here we go.
I do try to get, yeah, my husband was my boyfriend when I did the Bitcoin story. And he's also kind of journalism adjacent. So luckily he's supportive of the cause. But yes, when we did the smart home story, I can't remember if we were married by then, but yeah, I was like, are you willing to give up basically all these products in the home and will you do it with me? He said, I'm not going to do it with you because I have a job and that would be impossible. But sure, like you can put our Alexa Echo away for a while and I will not watch like the streaming giants. But yes, the most recent one I definitely had to get his go-ahead for because I was basically stalking him. There had been all these reports about how the new Apple AirTag was introduced by Apple to, you know, track your keys, track your wallet, track your bag, but people were finding it, you know, hidden behind the license plate of their car, finding it dropped in their coat pocket, in their purses, and people were very alarmed that it was making it too easy to track them. And so I'd written about that for the Times, and I wanted to basically see what it was like for a person who was tracking and being tracked and how easy it would be for them to realize that the technology was there. And so I did ask him, hey, would you be okay with me tracking your location? I didn't want to give him too many details because part of the challenge was, would he be aware of it? And he said, yes, but like you can't put like bugs or tracking onto my phone or my computer activity. And I said, no, I'm just interested in your in your location. I will only use physical trackers.
Yeah, that's in your vows. You can't put actual bugs on the phone.
But yes, I'm lucky. And I remember when I did the smart home story, my first daughter was pretty young. She was a toddler and she was so frustrated because she couldn't watch Coco in Monsters, Inc., which were her favorite movies at the time, because you couldn't access those kinds of movies without the intervention of the tech giants.
Wyze is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wyze just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wyze takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wyze. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wyze help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wyze worldwide. To learn more about how a Wyze account can work for you, download the app or visit Wyze.com. That's Wyze, W-I-S-E.com. Wyze.com.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you came to the New York Times, so you'd worked at Gizmodo and Forbes and Fusion, were you on staff?
Fusion, yeah, I was.
I don't know. Fusion hasn't come up in a long time. I've thought about Fusion in a few years. But when you came to the Times, the newspaper side of the Times, not traditionally known for in-depth first person. I mean, of course, it shows up. But was that something where they were like, this is what we want from you? Or you're saying, if you get me, this is my approach?
I mean, working at the New York Times is a dream, but I just didn't think it could ever be my dream because of my style of reporting. And I really came from the blogging world and did so much first person, and it wasn't something I necessarily associated with the Times. But they told me they really loved what I did, and they weren't hiring me to come write like the Times. They wanted me to do it like I've been doing it, and that they thought it was important work. And yeah, I have been loving it here. It's been 4 years now, and it's an amazing place to work. The editor's incredible. My colleagues are incredible. And I have been able to do amazing stories here. And I think that we're seeing more of it in the Times now. There's been incredible first-person reporting. The kind of famous one now is Kevin Roos and his interaction with Sydney, the evil AI part of Bing. But yeah, there's just so many great first-person stories here. Andy Newman working as a gig worker and kind of going all around Manhattan trying to make it work. So
that's what I sort of feel like you're pioneering it here. And then like you like roping in colleagues, like your colleague that you helped like slander himself online. Like in my head, it was you being like, no, come on, let's do one of these stories. But how did that actually come about?
It was a little bit like that.
Let's slander you. What would that look like?
I was like, my Google footprint is probably too big to destroy, but yours is a little smaller. Yes. So had done some reporting on online reputation and this woman who had kind of serially defamed her enemies, kind of going after them, going after their family members, their colleagues. Yeah, it was a story called A Vast Web of Vengeance. And all of these horrible things she was writing online were being kind of hosted and spread by these slander sites. And in order to really understand how they worked, it was a very murky world. It was hard to tell who owned which sites. And so we thought the best way to do it would be to do it ourselves. And the idea was someone needed to be slandered. And my colleague, Aaron Krolik, who's a technologist here, I've worked with on a lot of stories, and he's so great. And he said, yeah, I will do it. So
who came up with the actual, I love the actual like bit of slander, which is this man will do anything for attention, basically.
Because it's the New York Times, we wanted to make sure that we weren't spreading misinformation or disinformation. So Aaron basically came up with what he felt was a slander of himself that was true.
What does it look like when you like map one of these things out to get started?
So this is where I'm really thankful to work. And I've done this with a lot of my stories where I'll pair up with a technologist. Mm-hmm. And so with Surya Matu, when we did the smart home story, he built this VPN for me to monitor data flows. When I did the Getting Away from the Technology Giants, I worked with Dhruv Mehrotra, who's now at Wired, actually. And he built this VPN for me that would block my devices from being able to access the servers of the tech giants. And Aaron and I have worked on a couple of different stories together. And so, yeah, for this one, he came up with the system to watermark the photos so that we could see how they spread from site to site. And what we found was that the sites themselves are spreading the slander around and making it worse for anybody who has these kind of horrible lies written about them online. And what we suspected was happening and turned out to be true is that the slander sites had ties to the online reputation mitigation sites. And so it was essentially blackmail where you're kind of paying the same people to get rid of the slander who are helping it spread.
Yeah, that was an amazing part of the story. It's the same people.
It's the same people.
So in all of this privacy stuff, I mean, I feel like facial recognition was always this kind of like dystopian feel to it from a privacy perspective, but also for a very long time, and you mentioned it was 10 years before that you'd been to a conference. It was sort of like it didn't work, you know, for a long time, it just didn't work very well. And computer vision was such a backwater in terms of like successes. And so when it finally turned, had you been sort of like checking in on it over the years? Like, how did you sort of follow it so that you were ready for this moment?
Yeah. So I had been looking at facial recognition 10 years ago, and it was mostly at that point just a technology that was getting used to tag friends in photos. Mm-hmm. And even then, it didn't work great. It was more the, you know, when perfected, this is going to be scary kind of technology. And then a few years ago, I started getting interested in it again, actually, because of an artist slash technologist named Adam Harvey, who is kind of famous. He did a lot of like privacy surveillance art. He famously created CV Dazzle, which was this makeup that you could put on your face with like crazy geometric patterns that would subvert a facial recognition algorithm by making it so the program couldn't detect your face. They quickly fixed it, and CV Dazzle doesn't work anymore against facial recognition algorithms. So people still tout it as a solution all the time.
Really?
So if you've heard that, don't believe it. CV Dazzle will not protect you from facial recognition. But he had done this interesting project where he had looked at all the academic papers about facial recognition technology to see which databases they were using. So he created this website called exposing.ai that just went through and looked at the collection of photos that everybody was relying on. And there was one from Duke that was just like students who had been walking around in campus. There's one data set called Brainwash That was from a San Francisco cafe that had just been selling the surveillance footage of people that came in. And they're kind of bigger ones. There's one that came from Flickr photos that Yahoo researchers had put together. So anyways, I just was looking at it. And it was very much this culmination of something I've been writing about for a long time, which is us putting a whole bunch of information on the internet and then having it collected and used in unexpected ways. And while working on that, I realized that facial recognition had gotten better. Mm-hmm. But I didn't understand how much better it had gotten. There was still so much reporting about the flaws in the technology, particularly around bias and not working as well on people with different skin tones, not working as well for, you know, women as men, Black people as white people. So I still didn't realize how good it was. So when I first got this tip about Clearview AI, part of my skepticism was I just didn't think facial recognition worked this well. And they mm-hmm. claimed that they had something like 99% accuracy. And as I was talking to experts about it, you know, everyone was stunned. People were pretty skeptical that they had built a technology that worked. There was kind of this knowledge gap still where people, for the most part, didn't kind of realize how far the technology had come along. And so working on that story and then working on the book, of course, now have a better understanding of just how advanced facial recognition has gotten, thanks mostly to, you know, neural net technology and computers getting more powerful and having a lot more training data to work with.
So can you walk us through when you got the tip? So this company, no one's ever heard of this company, including experts in the field. So how did you go about trying to figure out what they were up to?
So I did what anybody would do. I went to clearview.ai, their website. And, you know, it just had, it was a pretty generic site. It had this kind of like Pac-Man-esque logo of the C chomping down on the V. And it said, artificial intelligence for a better world. And it said, you know, to get access, you know, basically put in your email address here. So I did.
Your Times address?
I think I did put my New York Times address in. And there was, and beyond that, all they had was an address. And it was an address in New York. And I don't think there was any contact information beyond that. But when I looked and mapped it on Google Maps, it was just a few blocks away from the New York Times office. So I was like, okay, as soon as I, you know, get back to New York, I'll just basically walk over there, which I did. And it was funny because I got to the place that Google Map pointed me to and the building wasn't there. There was no
such building.
There's no such building. I kept going back and forth. I'm like, is there something I'm missing? Like, where is this? And there was it was kind of like a delivery dock or something. So I went up to them. I said, where is this address? Is it like somewhere else? And they're like, oh, that doesn't exist. There's nothing here. There was a WeWork there. So I was like, okay, maybe they're in the WeWork. I went in. I said, is there a Clearview AI here? And they're like, no. And so that seemed really suspicious to me. And then I just tried to find anything I could about them. I was just kind of going through government websites. I mean, just looking for anything I could. And everyone I reached out to who was connected to Clearview AI just refused to respond. They wouldn't answer phone calls. They wouldn't answer emails. I just kept hitting dead ends. And I started to wonder if it was some kind of scam on police departments, if they're selling kind of like a magical, you know, snake oil product. But there was that legal memo from Paul Clement, which, of course, he wouldn't respond to me. But it seemed like, man, if you have the money to hire Paul Clement, this must be something real.
That's a serious scam.
So I kept hitting these closed doors. And so I thought, well, you know, they're selling it to police. They claim police are buying it. Let me go find the police departments that are using it. And I think I did that just through like an advanced Google search of looking for Clearview showing up in .gov websites and just see if it's on anybody's budget. And then, of course, had that FOIA from the original Paul Clement memo had come from the Atlanta Police Department. So I started reaching out to police departments. Atlanta ignored me. Most of them ignore me, which is not surprising. I've often found that law enforcement doesn't want to talk about the surveillance tools that they're using. But then I reached out to Gainesville Police Department, and they got back to me right away. They're like, yeah, we'd love to put you in touch with the detective who uses it. Like, we're really excited about it. And this detective calls me up. His name was Nick Ferrara. And he could not have been more excited to talk about Clearview. You know, he said it works incredibly well. It works like nothing I've used before. He was a financial crimes detective. And so he had a lot of images of people who had like gone to an ATM or gone to a bank counter and committed, you know, financial fraud. He said, you know, I'd run a lot of these photos through the face recognition system that we used before here in Florida. That's mostly around mugshots. It's older technology. He said, you know, had no leads. And then I started running them through Clearview AI, and I got hit after hit after hit, and it got these cases moving. He said, I'd be their spokesperson if they wanted me. Like, he loved it. And
I imagined in the movie version of this, where everyone's in the newsroom, you like standing up and being like, I got him. I got the guy.
Well, what's funny is when I was like, you know, about to go on maternity leave, my editor had just left. So I was kind of between editors at the times. And, you know, I'm about to go. And so I think that I was probably just going to float around with no editor until I left to go have my baby. And so I went to Ellen Pollack, who runs business where I work. And I said, Ellen, like, I've got a big story. I really need an editor for it. And I got paired up with incredible investigative editor here named David Enrich. And so he was very helpful because it was a challenging story to report out, since Clearview itself really did not want to talk to me. And they went to pretty extreme lengths to try to discourage me from gathering information.
Yeah, including you tried to do, I mean, it wasn't like a fully immersion situation like we were talking about before, but it seems like one of your initial impulses was run my photo. Like, let's see what comes up.
Yeah, I was like, I want to see what one of these searches is like. And Nick Farrar was like, well, I can't give you like my police investigative work because it would compromise my cases. But he said he was willing to run my own photo. And so I emailed him three photos, and he had said it worked really well, even if somebody's looking away from the camera, if they're wearing a hat. So I sent him three photos, like I think one where I was wearing sunglasses and a hat, one where my eyes were closed, and one where I was looking away from the camera. And then he just disappeared on me. And I was calling him, I was emailing him, and he just stopped responding, which was a little strange. And I wasn't sure what had happened because he'd been so eager to talk about the company before. Meanwhile, I found another detective to talk to. And he, like the first detective, was really excited about the tool. He said it didn't work all the time, that if somebody was an online ghost and didn't have a lot of photos online, it wasn't going to get a hit. But he said it had worked in a recent case he'd worked on, of a sexual assault case where the woman had taken a photo of the guy in the bar earlier in the night, and he had just used that photo to kind of track this guy down. And he made the same offer, I'll run your photo and I can show you what it's like. And so I sent him a photo and he ran it and he said, oh, there's no results for you. And I was like, oh, that's really odd. Like, I do have a lot of photos online. He said, yeah, when I Google your name, there's a lot of photos. I would expect you to have results. And he said, you know, maybe their servers are down right now. And then he also stopped talking to me. But it wasn't until I ended up kind of recruiting a detective with the help of a colleague here at the Times. He went to Clearview's site, put in his email address, quickly got a response, had access to the app within a half an hour, and he ran photos of some suspects whose identity he knew. It worked. He actually ran his own photo, and he's been very careful to keep photos of himself off of the internet because of the work he does. He doesn't want to be really trackable by maybe people who are upset about him enforcing the law on them. And so he ran this photo of himself, not expecting to get any results. Mm-hmm. And then he did get a hit. And when you run a photo through Clearview AI, it'll just show you the face and there'll be a link to where the photo appears. And he could see that it came from Twitter. So he clicks on the photo and it's from a Pride festival that he had been patrolling. And it was somebody had taken a photo of two people who were in the foreground and he was in the background of the photo. His head was like really tiny. I could not tell. He showed me the two photos. I couldn't tell it was the same person.
Oh, wow.
But he was in uniform. He actually had his tag on his uniform. So it would have led to his name. And he was really stunned by it. His first thought was of undercover police officers and how this was going to make their lives more difficult. And I told him about this experience I'd had with these two other people who'd run my photo, one of whom hadn't gotten any results. And so he ran my photo. He said, yep, no results. And then a couple of minutes later, he gets a call from somebody at Clearview AI telling them they were with Clearview tech support. And had he just run a photo of this woman from the New York Times, Kashmir Hill, and he was a little cagey and said, you know, how would I know somebody at the New York Times? And they said, well, you just ran a photo. Like, it violates our terms of service to run a reporter's photo, and we're going to have to deactivate your account. And so then I figured out, you know, why the other detectives had gone cold on me. It was that the company had been tracking who was submitting my photo and had blocked the results for my photo, which just gave me this peek at how much power they had to not only see who police were looking for, but controlling whether that person was findable. And it was very alarming for the police officer I was working with, because he said, you know, a company shouldn't have this kind of access. They shouldn't know who police officers are looking for.
Yeah. And it also, it's just such a fascinating journalistic moment, because it's like you discovering really directly this thing that you kind of assume is happening, which is, you know, you contact some company that doesn't want to talk to you. They're all talking to each other, and then they're trying to figure out what to do about it. And you actually experience this kind of like, they put you on a list, like a watch list to look out for you. And when you realized that was true, did that change your approach at all to the reporting, knowing that they had actually like excluded you from the database, knowing that you were probably doing this with police departments all around the country?
I found it chilling. I also felt bad, like I'd exposed my sources in that way, when I just hadn't been thinking about it, which I kind of took to heart and just have to think about it for future reporting that I've done since then. But yeah, I mean, I realized, okay, they fully know about me. They clearly still don't want me to do this story, but it only made me more eager to tell the story and to try to get them to talk to me. My real breakthrough was I looked Clearview up on PitchBook, which is a website that tracks startups, and they had a like really kind of skimpy entry for them. And it said that they had two investors. One was Peter Thiel, who I think if you follow technology at all, very familiar name, you know, one of the PayPal founders, made a lot of money investing in Facebook, founded Palantir, one of the data mining juggernauts that works with governments and corporations. And so I reached out to Thiel's spokesperson, and he was like, oh, okay, what's the company? Clearview AI, let me see if we have an investment in them. Like, doesn't sound familiar to me. Then never responded to me, stopped returning my phone calls. And then the other investor was a venture capital firm called Kiranaga Partners. And they were actually based in New York, in Bronxville, just like north of Manhattan. And so I got on the train and went to their offices. It was very suburban, very empty office. This is pre-pandemic when people actually went to offices. But they were on this long hallway. And there was just like nobody around. And I knocked on their door and called their number, and nothing was happening inside the office. Talked to the neighbors, and they said, oh, they never come in. They're never here. A delivery guy came by to drop off some package for them. And he's like, yeah, I've never seen them. They never come into the office. So I figured it was another dead end, but I kind of like lingered in the hallway for an hour, slacking my editor, David Henrich, being like, what should I do? And finally decided to leave. And I'm coming, it's on the second floor, and I'm coming down the stairs, and these two guys walk into the lobby, and they just looked moneyed.
They had that VC look.
They had the VC look, like, you know, the like pink shirt, the lilac tie, gray suits. And I just said, hey, are you with Kiranaga Partners? And they looked up at me and they were smiling and they're like, yeah, we are. And I said, I'm Kashmir Hill. I'm the New York Times reporter who's been calling and emailing you. And their faces just fell. And David Scalzo was one of them. He's the firm's founder. And he said, oh, well, Clearview's lawyer said we're not supposed to talk to you. And so I'm wearing a coat. It's winter. I kind of open my coat to show my like very pregnant belly. And I was like, oh, I came all this way. I really wanted to talk to you. Like, do you think we just sit down? Maybe we can talk off the record. And so David Scalzo was like, okay. And he takes me into the office and we sit down and have some water. And, you know, he just was so clearly excited about the investment in Clearview. And I laid out for him the reporting I'd done, that I talked to police officers. I was definitely going to do this story. that the company's not talking to me, and it looked really sketchy. And I said, you know, it would be good if there's somebody to talk on the company's behalf. And so he said, okay, you know, well, let's go on the record. And yes, started telling me some wild things about how Clearview AI, you know, was selling to law enforcement. It was spreading like wildfire through law enforcement agencies. You know, I'd find out that they had been used by thousands of law enforcement agencies, not just in the U.S., but around the world. He said, but that's not all they want to do. They want to sell it to everybody. You know, they want to be in hotels. They want to be in office buildings. Like, I think everyone's going to have Clearview on their phone. And it's just going to be like, instead of Googling somebody, you'll Clearview somebody. And it means you're searching their face and finding out who they are. You know, I was like, well, that's kind of alarming. That kind of means the end of anonymity as we know it. And he said, well, this is the nature of technology. You know, there's not going to be privacy. It's advancing all the time. And it's kind of dystopian, but you can't ban it. And so after that, people started talking to me, and Clearview decided that it was time to talk to me because they weren't going to be stopping the story.
Real credit for lingering in the hallway. That's like... So much information available online, and you got the story by traveling to the place and sitting there for however long.
Yeah, doorstepping still works. And just getting lucky, because they really did not come into the office very often. So I just think about that, like if I'd taken a different train, if I miss them by 10 minutes, sometimes you just get those lucky breaks as a reporter, and I got one right then.
Well, I often ask people who, you know, take a series of stories and then expand it into a book, like what... You know, what made you think this was a book, or at what point you know this was a book? You may have a different answer, but it, just what you've described so far, a huge, huge story. But then when you actually discover who's behind this company and the incredible constellation of bizarre characters that are involved, I feel like even reading like the first newspaper story or second newspaper, when it all kind of was like starting to come into focus, it felt like a book to me. Like, is that how it felt to you? Like, how is this possibly opening up into these avenues after it's already this interesting?
Yeah, it was. So as I find out, so I'm sitting in that office and I'm saying it with the Kiranaga investors, and I'm like, well, but who built this? Like, who is the mastermind who, as far as I could tell, had made this like incredible technological breakthrough and built a database like nothing we had seen before, even from Google or Facebook or even a government? And he said, oh, you know, he's a genius. I found earlier somebody that on LinkedIn who said they worked for Clearview, and their name was John Good, and they were listed as a sales manager, and they had no connections, and of course reached out to them and they didn't respond. So he's like, his name is Juan Tan Tat, but he goes by John Good on LinkedIn because he has a little bit of Gawker history. And he had to write the name on the board for me because it was unusual spelling. And so I left that interview, and I'm sitting on the train Googling Juan Tan Tat, and the first article that came up was on ValleyWag, and it was about this hacker who had like a phishing scheme. And anyways, it was I could understand why he didn't like his history. Juan Tan Tat had partnered up with this guy, Richard Schwartz, who was decades older than him, who had worked for Rudy Giuliani. And that's all I kind of knew initially, but would find out other people connected to it. But yeah, after I did that first story, I was 8 months pregnant when the story came out in the Sunday edition, and just more stuff kept coming in. I kept talking to people. I found out that, you know, trying to raise money, they had been meeting with all these investors, and part of the pitch was that they would give them access to Clearview AI. Mm-hmm. And I start finding out it's being used by like people who work for Sequoia, which is a really big venture capital firm in Silicon Valley. Ashton Kutcher had gotten the app. He talked about it in a Hot Ones video on YouTube. I found out that this billionaire in New York, John Catsimatidis, he's run for mayor. He owns the Grissettes Market, that he'd gotten access to the app, that they tried to put Clearview AI in his grocery stores to catch shoplifters. So I call him up. And he starts telling me about this time that, you know, he didn't end up putting it into his supermarkets, but he had the app on his phone and how great it was because his daughter walked into a restaurant he was at once at Cipriani, and she had like a suitor on her arm and he wanted to know who it was. And so he had the waiter take a photo of them and then Clearviewed the guy's face and found out exactly who he was and texted his daughter. the guy's bio and said he approved, you know. There were just so many different lines of reporting, and I was fascinated by them all. And so I kept reporting even after my daughter was born. I was like calling down Kat's Matisse, and I had my newborn like in the ergo on my chest. And I'm bouncing her, trying to keep her calm while I'm talking to Kat's Matisse and like interviewing him. I just couldn't put the story down. So yeah, it was pretty evident to me early on that I would say that it could be a book. And my editors, because I kept pitching story after story about all this, and they're like, you definitely have a book here. Like, you should write a book proposal.
We can't publish all these stories.
But, you know, I just had my second child. I was pretty busy. And so it really took the pandemic for me to have the time to sit down and write the proposal and really figure out how big it could be and how do you put this together? How do you structure this? What are the big questions I wanted to answer? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just from the very beginning, I just felt like the story was so fascinating and the characters were so interesting and just trying to understand their motivations and how they got here.
Yeah. Well, one you haven't mentioned is this guy, Charles Johnson, who again, like he just has this whole internet history separate from being involved in this story, touching on white supremacy, internet, and certainly far-right internet and, you know, Trump and all kinds of connections. But then the thing I wanted to ask you was, I mean, this is a spoiler a little bit, so people should read the book, but like he ends up getting driven out of the company or cut out of the company. And clearly he was also a good source in terms of like the information he had about how the whole thing started and how it had been invented and this, that, and the other. So how did you sort of balance the idea of you've got this guy with this kind of treasure trove who also has this very checkered history, who also potentially has an axe to grind? I was just interested in how you like worked with him as a source.
Yeah. So Charles Johnson is somebody I heard after the first Clearview story, I started hearing from a lot of people. Like it was funny because Clearview AI was not known by the general public, but there were all these very powerful and rich people who knew about the app and had access to the app and had been using the app. And so after that first story came out, kind of breaking the fact of their existence, people started reaching out to me. And what I started hearing from particularly investors who had been approached was, yeah, we heard about Clearview. We had concerns. There were ethical issues about what they had built, you know, scraping all those photos, whether they had the legal right to use them. But also they had these conservative ties that we didn't like. And particularly to this guy, Charles Johnson. And Charles Johnson was a person I had heard of before, also known as Chuck Johnson. And yeah, had like a kind of long history as this conservative provocateur. David Carr wrote this great profile of him, sowing mayhem one click at a time. And so I reached out to him, and that was the start of like a very strange reporter source relationship, because he's just a strange, how do I describe him? He was one of those people who at first didn't want to talk to me, and Clearview I didn't want to kind of acknowledge his existence, and he wanted to be recognized as an important player in the development of Clearview AI. And so he was one of those people that I had to really understand his motivation and, you know, why would he want to talk to me and why is Clearview AI so not want to be associated with him. It felt a little bit like the movie Rashomon, the Akira Kurosawa film, where you're seeing the same narrative told through all these different characters. I've never felt the presence of that film so strongly as reporting on the Clearview AI story, because everybody had this different narrative of exactly how Clearview AI had come together. And when I first met Juan Tontat, he told me this version of the story where he and Richard Schwartz, I was like, how'd you meet this guy? You know, like you're this young coder, you know, from San Francisco, and he is an old time Politico who worked for Rudy Giuliani. Like, how did your paths cross? He said, oh, well, we met at the Manhattan Institute at a book event. And I said, oh, you know, what was the book? And he's like, I don't remember. And so even at the time, I thought that was strange. And then Charles Johnson comes along and he's like, actually, I'm the one who introduced Richard Schwartz and Juan Tontat. And I was like, well, you know, where are the receipts? And Charles Johnson ended up being a person who was very willing to share emails. And he had just been on all these emails with the company very early on. He clearly was part of it as it was forming and developing. And he ended up sharing that with me. And so that was very helpful in understanding the story, because every person involved had kind of a different version of events. But having the emails, I ended up like doing this big spreadsheet of, you know, like, when is he close to them? When is he far from them? When did they have this break? And his talking to me ended up getting him into all kinds of trouble. And Clearview AI kind of used his talking with me to fully boot him from the company, because they said he was violating a confidentiality clause. Anyways, it was complicated and interesting, but it was very, very helpful to be able to see the emails, because what they were conceiving in the beginning wasn't just a facial recognition app. It was this app that was supposed to be able to tell you much more about somebody just based on their face. They were talking about being able to, you know, judge your criminality and your intelligence, your likelihood of being a cheater or a drug abuser. It was really kind of tapping into the physiognomy and phrenology, these kind of discredited sciences.
Some real digital phrenology going on at the beginning. Yeah,
that goes back to Aristotle and kind of Victorian scientists. So it was really interesting to follow that thread in the book and then in the Clearview AI story.
You've obviously written about this for so many years, and you said earlier that you were kind of, you know, looking for the danger, like, where's the real danger here in terms of privacy loss from various technologies? And so now you have this, they're on the extreme, like, they're doing the thing that everyone said, oh, well, no one will ever do that. Like, no one will ever just release it to people to use for whatever, and they're giving it to law enforcement. But obviously there are people who think that it's powerful and it's valuable. And so how did you kind of, like, with your history of writing about this stuff, also try to make space for, I guess, the other side, the sort of, like, why would we want this thing? Like, what could be the possible positive benefits of it?
Yeah, and I try to be fair in that, because, you know, I did talk to a lot of police officers who really value a tool like this. Like, this is a powerful technology that when a crime is committed and all they have is a face, this can give them a lead. And I think that's valid. I mean, there's also a downside of that if they just go with that lead and really assume that the person surfaced by a facial recognition algorithm is their offender. And there have been a number of mistaken arrests at this point because of that. Like, the police did not do enough investigating beyond the face match.
Those stories are harrowing.
They're horrible.
One, I feel like, did you have one in the Times that was not even in the book?
Yeah.
A more recent one?
The most recent story is a woman named Portia Woodruff, 8 months pregnant. Police show up at her door to arrest her for carjacking and robbery that had been committed 2 weeks earlier by a person who was not pregnant. And she ended up going to jail for the day, you know, getting charged, had to go to the hospital as soon as she was released because she was so stressed out by the arrest. So it can be a valuable tool, but it can also lead police astray. So even when it is used well, or used for a good reason, there's still downsides. So I try to balance that. Like, there are benefits, there are downsides. I can imagine a world in which we all have this technology on our phones, because, and I don't know about you, but there's many times I could imagine using something like this for something as banal as, you know, you're at a work conference and you're introduced to somebody that you should already know and you don't want to ask their name, and you could just quickly, you know, take a photo, find out who they are, and not have that kind of embarrassing, sorry that I forgot you.
Yeah.
But there's also so many chilling ways it can be used. There are many people that are opposed to the use of facial recognition. They say, you know, whether it works or whether it doesn't, it shouldn't exist. It's like nuclear weapons. It's just too dangerous to be out there. I think it's going to be part of our lives. And the question right now is, how widespread do we want it to be? How many people should have access to it? What are the restrictions going to be?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I try to acknowledge that this might be just a way that privacy changes, that maybe we'll live in a world where you just don't have this kind of anonymity. I often think of, I remember in my early days reporting on privacy, I don't know if you got this, but there was a tech company that used to circulate an article about caller ID. There was a time with our phones, when somebody called you, all you saw was a number and you didn't know who the person was until you picked up. And then caller ID was introduced.
It's amazing you have to explain that too. people, but
the young listeners on the podcast.
The old phones, they didn't tell you anything about who was calling.
And so caller ID was introduced, and it would tell you who the person was before you picked up so you could decide whether to pick up or not. And so there was a technology company that circulated this article about privacy advocates being really opposed to caller ID, that you should have the right to call people without them knowing who you were. And they were circulating this to say, hey, notions of privacy change a lot. And, you know, now if somebody calls you on a blocked number, you don't know who they are. That's the intrusive thing. Like, you don't want to pick up. And so I do kind of wonder if we'll have a flip like that when it comes to our faces, that there'll be a time when the idea that you can't search this person's face in a bar to make sure they are who they really say they are will be the thing that's seen as the harm.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, because it's, yeah. Anyways, as documented in the book, there's just so many chilling uses. I think the best example is Madison Square Garden deciding that they don't want lawyers who work at firms that have sued them to come in anymore. And so, yeah. So when thousands of lawyers that work at something like 90 firms just get turned away at the door and told you can't come to a Knicks game, you can't come to a Mariah Carey concert until your firm drops its suit. And I could just see that really spreading and just kind of this new era of discrimination where you write a bad Yelp review of a business and the next time you go there, they don't let you in, or, you know, they spit in your soup and you don't know about it.
The lawyers one seemed funny also because it's a little bit self-defeating. Like, if you own a big venue, like, thousands of law partners are probably the people that you want to come to, whether their law firm has sued you or not, they have the money to come rent the box or whatever. So,
and if you're trying to discourage litigation, you maybe don't want to ban a bunch of lawyers because you know they're going to come after you in court.
But that's something I wonder about, sort of the arc of your career and this particular topic, because I'm sure, you know, you've heard, even I've written about it much less, but you hear all the same arguments over and over again from people, and they say, well, if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about, or it's inevitable anyway, so we want to try to do it this way that's better than the bad people would do if we try to contain it. You know, the arguments kind of like they repeat, and then the phenomenon repeats that a thing that people would never do or they think they would never do, 5 years later, they're doing it. They're sharing their photos, they're doing this, they're doing that. And how does that feel in terms of covering it? Do you ever kind of despair is too strong a word, but does it get to you that the way this goes often is that you raise an alarm and maybe some marginal changes are made, but the thing happens anyway?
I think the marginal changes are important.
Mm.
And I think that is where the victories are. But yeah, I often do feel like what my work is doing is preparing people for the way the world is going to change. And with something like facial recognition technology, that's really important, because if the world is changing such that every photo of you taken that's uploaded is going to be findable, it's going to change the decisions that you make. And so, like, something I'm starting to hear about is people who created OnlyFans accounts during the pandemic, which is kind of like a risque, you know, online work was a way to make money when people didn't have jobs. And that they kind of assumed if they didn't have their real name on those accounts, they wouldn't be associated with their identity. And now I'm hearing that those people are starting to find that those accounts are being associated with them by people who are doing facial recognition searches. And so part of this is just making sure that information is distributed to all so they can be prepared for it. Or if you get arrested for something and you know that you had nothing to do with the crime, maybe you should know that police are using facial recognition technology and kind of help you do your defense. But one of the themes of the book that I think is reassuring is that privacy laws work. The greatest example is Illinois passed this law, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, giving people rights to their, you know, face prints, voice prints, fingerprints, you know, biometric identifiers, that companies can't use it without their consent. This law got passed in 2008, really a prescient law. And the book explains how it is that they thought of this kind of before most of the rest of the country. But this means that people in Illinois have better protection for their faces than the rest of us. You know, something like Clearview is not allowed there. And it's interesting because Madison Square Garden, they have a venue in Chicago. They have a theater there, and they can't use their facial recognition technology there. They can't bar lawyers with face recognition in Chicago because you're not allowed to do that. You can't use people's face prints without their consent. Mm-hmm. And so we can make laws that will make a difference, and it has happened. Europe, too, has stronger privacy laws than the United States, and they've said that what Clearview built was illegal, and Clearview has stopped doing business in Europe because of that. So we can shape the future that we want, and I think with facial recognition technology specifically, we're still in a place where we can do that, and so that's where I feel like the book matters right now. We don't. It's not inevitable that we all have a Clearview AI app on our phone, but it is likely to happen if we don't do something to avert it.
I feel like this comes up in the book. You properly credit other people who are reporting on this topic, but I mean, you owned this story. This story, you broke this story. Clearview AI is your story. But then, like, some other great tech reporters, including Ryan Mack, who was at BuzzFeed News and is now at the Times, started breaking parts of it. Like, all the police departments that were using it and got this data about Clearview AI. And now he's your colleague, but like, what's your relationship to like other reporters kind of like eating away at a story that you so fully own?
Yeah. I mean, in a way it's awesome. You're like, wow, I did this story that made such a difference that everyone else is chasing it. And yeah, the BuzzFeed team did great reporting. Huffington Post did great reporting. I mean, there was such great reporting that was coming from all over the place. My favorites were local reporters who now were aware of Clearview AI and started doing public records requests to their local law enforcement agencies. And so it was like, I felt like Johnny Appleseed, just kind of like throwing my seeds out to the world. I mean, yeah, there were reports in Australia. It was like all over the place. So I would have to say it was incredible to see that wave of coverage. Because I thought it was important for people to know how the technology was getting used. Certainly jealousy factor to see some big scoops. BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed's had this really great get where they got access to a list of customers that Clearview AI had, and they built this incredible database, which was really helpful for my reporting, of everybody who had used it and how many searches they had run approximately at the time that BuzzFeed got the information. So it was a mix of jealousy and admiration for colleagues getting great stories, but it was also helpful, especially as I was doing the book and putting it all together, to have all these resources of people at the national publications, but also a lot of local journalists who did really, really great work.
This is both about facial recognition, but also just all of your reporting. I mean, you've put yourself in the middle of these situations. You've given up your own privacy for our sake in some ways, including having your face eventually was run by Clearview. Like, you did have them run your face.
Several times, actually, yeah.
And so, do you ever have this impulse? I have this impulse, and maybe many people do, that, you know what? You know what I'd love to do is just like flick all these switches off. Like, just leave it all. Like, Facebook, Instagram, just turn them all off. Or either that or for my kids, just turn it all off for them. Do you have that impulse? And like, how does that manifest in your life, given all the reporting that you've done on this?
Gosh. Yeah, I think I often think about the story I did about getting away from the technology giants. And one of the best things that I did during that almost 2-month period was I had to give up, because I was giving up Google and Apple, I had to get rid of my smartphone. And so I went back to using like an old Nokia, like one of those little orange bricks of a phone. And it was such a relief to my brain to turn off the internet, you know, unless I was sitting in front of a computer. And it broke this kind of habit I had of waking up every morning and, you know, first thing you do is the thumb lap on your phone and looking at my phone the last thing before I went to bed, because when you have just one of those old cell phones, all it does is text. And yeah, I mean, I do sometimes feel overwhelmed thinking about how connected we all are. And I thought about this in the context of the book because of the nature of privacy. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of privacy scholars say that privacy is a novel concept, and that, you know, in the before times when we all lived in like very small villages with a very small number of people, you knew everyone and they knew everything going on in your life. And that privacy really arose through urbanization and moving to big cities where you could be anonymous. And sometimes I feel like technology is taking us back to this small town feel, except we're in this small town of billions of people. And it just kind of can feel, yeah, just overwhelming. I just wonder about the extent to which our brains can adapt to this much stimulation. So yeah, so I think about it a lot, and we talk about the limits that need to be put on technology to kind of protect society, but I think all of us are thinking more and more about the limits we need to put on technology in our own lives to just live and be healthy and fulfilled and be good role models for our children and not have them frustrated because you're always looking at your phone.
Well, I hope you don't shut it all off, because I'm counting on you to keep reporting on this so that the rest of us can possibly figure out what we need to shut down. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. This is amazing.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to Kashmir Hill. Her book is out now. It's called Your Face Belongs to Us. Our show this week was edited by Jackie Sajiko. Our show notes were from Megan Valley. I'm Evan Ratliff. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. Thanks to Vox for partnering with us on this show. Thanks to you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.